Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you today?
I'm just ducky, and I know we discussed right before we got in the air that we want to talk today about a little birthday celebration that you and some of my other friends and Jennifer had for me at the Devon Tavern in New York City.
It's a place that you've been talking about for quite some time, and a really cool place downtown, just a couple of doors down from Tribeca Grill on Greenwich Street. And we went there. We had a private celebration in a private room for your birthday with a lot of close friends, some of which in the restaurant business, some of which not. And one of the things that you've been talking about this place is this is a really great place, and I don't understand why it hasn't caught on more.
You know, I want to encourage people to go to the Devon Tavern. I go back there quite often because it's owned by the same guy who owns a very successful steakhouse called Dylan Prime.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Dylan Prime's busy. I went there for a cocktail event with Dales Groff and Audrey Saunders and mm-hmm. and Jim Meehan and Corey Hill and a lot of other cocktailians from Manhattan for a benefit for the Museum of the American Cocktail in May. We had a great time. I thought the place was beautiful. So I started going back. And every time I've gone, it's been rather quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't understand. Now, it's not dead as a doornail, but it's
right.
rather quiet. And
well,
for New York.
It's a fairly large space, and you can pretty much see the entire space when you're sitting at the bar. So if it's not completely full, it has an empty feeling to it. There's that design part of it, I think, maybe could have been better, but it should be busy. It was very good.
The place is beautiful. Exposed
mm-hmm.
brick, fireplaces, candles everywhere. The lighting is perfect.
Private rooms, very attractive bar.
And I just, you know, I have to say, Mark and I do a lot of restaurant consulting.
Mm-hmm.
We're and ever since the radio show, more and more, and I think we help people have a lot of success. Mark and I walk into restaurants, whether we're consulting or not, and we often think, if a restaurant, especially if it's not working, we think to ourselves,
what would I change?
Yeah, I mean, and we don't say it to other people, but mm-hmm. it's just we say, oh, you know what, I could change it, that we could fix that, or this might be different, or here's the problem they're having with that. I walk into the Devon Tavern, and I think, wow, the place is beautiful. The people were very nice.
Mm-hmm.
The service was very good. The wine director was great. The wine list is terrific. The bartenders were
cocktail
very nice.
List is great.
And but I just don't. And the food was very, very good.
And the food was very good. I can't say anything. I couldn't think of a negative thing to say about the food if I wanted to.
And I can't understand why the place isn't busy. I mean, I'm thrilled. I always get a seat and a table whenever I want, but I wanted to stay there. So if you want to check that place out, you can go. Try it. It's on Greenwich Street in Manhattan. And it's thedevontavern.com. And I understand they do a lot of corporate business. They do
mm-hmm.
private parties during the week.
Some great private rooms. I'll tell you, the private room we were in probably sat up to about 30 or so, and there was another private room downstairs with a private bar room downstairs,
stunning.
Too.
Stunning.
That was really spectacular, and it was one of those things where you're like, people should be taking advantage of this. This is a really good place with great wine lists, with great food, and it is the scary thing about the restaurant business, and Francis alluded to this before. The scary thing about the restaurant business is you can have all the factors there. You can have great food. You can have great service. You can have a good location. You can have, perfect ambiance.
And be nice.
And be nice. And it just never quite comes together. And for some reason, people don't come in the numbers that you expect them to come.
Well, here's the deal. They've stayed open for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember some people were looking at them last summer saying, oh, I wonder how long they can last. And the thing is, they've got the other place to have a cash flow. They seem busy enough, maybe.
Sure.
And they're really great people. And so here's what we're going to do. I want to all the Restaurant Guys listeners to go to the Devon Tavern, tell them that the Restaurant Guys sent you, and we're going to turn this place around, you know.
That'd be great.
I don't know if they need saving. I wonder how the owner would react to listening to this show.
Do
you think we were jerks, or do you think we're nice?
I don't know.
don't know. But in any event, Devon Tavern, I've had a great time there 20 times. Had a great birthday party there.
And I can tell you, I've only been once, but it was very good.
So I would go. And if you appreciate the aesthetic of a bar, it's a beautiful, beautiful place. So I'd check that out. DevonTavern.com. We'll even link to it on our website, RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Let's talk about another type of place that is packed and for no good reason.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take that back, for no good reason. But that is more packed than it should be. I heard recently there's a Cheesecake Factory that opened up in New Jersey that in their first year of business there, their annual receipts are $12 million.
It's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty good. That's a pretty busy restaurant.
It's pretty busy.
It's pretty busy. In order to do $12 million in a restaurant like that, you've got to be busy all the time. Lunch, dinner, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, doesn't matter, day of the week, you've really got to turn and burn.
I've been to the Cheesecake Factory, and you know what? As far as those chains go, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. It's not that good.
Yet people will wait on a line for 2 hours to go to a restaurant like that because they saw the commercial or because, you know what it is, and I really believe this, there is a perceived value in places like that. I don't think it's a true value, but it's a perceived value in places like that because of things like a kid's menu or things where there's an alternative, inexpensive menu. And I think that somehow they've gotten into people's subconscious.
I think that the chains are easy for people. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand. Look, what do they have, 100 menus on their 100 items on their menu? It's like mm-hmm. they have a Mexican menu and an Italian menu. If you're doing all that, you're not doing any of it great.
Well, here's where I understand the concept of the chain restaurant and where my instinct is to say, wow, then maybe a chain restaurant is a good place to eat. You're eating someplace foreign to you, completely foreign to you, and you want to go someplace that's totally safe. And I understand why when you're traveling to Oklahoma, you might go to a Cheesecake Factory or Red Lobster or Bennigan's or any one of those places.
I don't. I never would. I would go to the local place.
I would too. But I understand the needing something that's safe and feeling like you want to go to a place where there's not going to be any surprises. What I don't understand is you live in Woodbridge, New Jersey, and you have opportunities to go to lots of local restaurants, and you elect to go to one of the chains. That's the part I don't understand.
Here's what I don't understand.
The part that doesn't make sense to me. And wait online for 2 hours.
I can understand. I was Christmas shopping with Jennifer in December, and mm-hmm. we were at a mall, and we were tired, and we were hungry, and there was a chain in the mall, and mm-hmm. I knew we could get in and get a burger and have food in our stomachs within 12 minutes.
Right.
Okay? And I thought, you know what? Let's just sit down, had a beer at the bar, and at this other different chain. You know, it was okay. And
had
it was
a hamburger that you had to order medium well.
And it was food as fuel, and it was food for convenience. Mm-hmm. And once in a while you do that. What I can't understand for the life of me is that you would wait 2 hours for a meal that's going to take 30 minutes.
And make that your Saturday night.
And have a frozen hamburger patty, or have a hamburger mm-hmm. patty that's not as good as you could make at home.
You could make it home in 15 minutes instead of waiting 2 hours.
Hours, you could go home, make a whole meal, eat it, and do the dishes. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking today with Suzanne Goen. She is a tremendous chef from California. She was named Best Creative Chef by Boston Magazine in 1994, one of the Best New Chefs by Food and Wine in 1999. She was nominated for James Beard Awards in 03, 04, and 05. And then in 06, she actually won some, thank heaven. She and her business partner run restaurants Luke and AOC in Los Angeles, and she's co-owner of the Hungry Cat Restaurants with her husband, David Lentz.
Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for being on. So that must have been a heartbreaker, being nominated in 03, 04, and 05. They made you wait till 06 to win those James Beard Awards?
You know what? I was happy to wait those 4 years, because I remember the first year I was nominated, I actually felt very not worthy, and so there were so many other people that were nominated that I really thought should win.
So my guess is by 06 you felt more worried.
By 06 I was okay with it. But I wasn't chomping. It wasn't one of those things like if I don't win I'm out of here, which I think sometimes happens. Like some people get nominated so many times. Believe it or not, 4 times is actually not that many times. I mean, there are people who are nominated like 10 times. You don't ever, at that point, just like stop nominating me.
Well, but no, but hey, man, even a nomination, that's, you know, that's like that's the Academy
deal.
Award nominee,
no, it's true.
You know,
it's
has its own
true.
Cachet.
It is very true.
Well, so now your restaurants are out in Los Angeles.
Yes, in West Hollywood.
And Los Angeles has a unique part of the mind of the American food psyche. I mean, I seem to have read over the last, you know, 15, 20 years I've been watching this, how Los Angeles doesn't have any great restaurants. Los Angeles is the seed of all the great new restaurants. Los Angeles doesn't have any restaurants. Los Angeles has a food renaissance. Los Angeles doesn't have any restaurants.
Right.
What's it like doing business out in Los Angeles and being part of that?
And being one or both of those things at any given time.
Well, it's funny. I actually grew up here, so I've sort of seen the whole. I mean, I remember when it actually does go up and down. I mean, I remember when there were no great. There were two good restaurants, and they were both very, very sort of old school French. And then there was sort of a little kind of culinary renaissance that happened, and then it maybe kind of died out, and then it maybe came back again. I think now we're in a really great and kind of interesting position. I think a lot of the homegrown chefs, the restaurants here are chef-owned. Small and chef-owned, which I think is great. And so we have that going on. We have an amazing farmer's market, so we have great access to produce that I don't think that very, very few places in the country have. And that's very much influenced the style of cooking here, which is great. And then now, recently, there's a big influx of a lot of New York chefs, actually, chefs from around the country, and particularly New York chefs who are moving here. It's like L.A.'s, or not, opening places here. It's sort of like L.A.'s been discovered in its own weird way. There's a BLT steak that just opened. Kraft just opened. We had Norman Van Aken opened a restaurant here, which actually closed.
That doesn't count then.
That doesn't count. Well, he opened it. But it feels like all of a sudden, you know, having grown up here, I remember, you know, when New Yorkers hated L.A. And now I feel like New Yorkers, everyone we talk to comes in the restaurant, it's like, oh, yeah, we love coming out here for the weekend. It's so fun. We do this and that. Even people from San Francisco who, you know, L.A. used to be. I remember I didn't even know there was this whole rivalry until I went to, I moved up north and was working at Chez Panisse, and people would ask me where I was from, and I said Los Angeles, and their response would be, I'm sorry. And I was like, what are they talking? I had no idea, because it's a funny thing. Like, people in L.A. love San Francisco. We have, we're sort of like the, you know, like, oh, yeah, San Francisco's great, New York's great, and little do we know, like, all these people can't stand us. But well, I think they've gotten over it.
Well, you know, I think one of the interesting things, I find Los Angeles' relationship with great restaurants to be at a unique part of the American relationship with food and cuisine, because now, look, style and restaurants, you know, that's part of our culture. You know, restaurants are I don't want to say a seat of power, but they're an important part of what it is to be stylish, what it is to have a good life, what it is to be, you know, I mean, they even have a role in people trying to eat healthy and well.
Right.
And organic and sustainable and all that. But for a long time, I remember in New York, even in the late 80s, there were a whole cadre of very fashionable restaurants that were, what we would say about them was, that's one of those places where models go to not eat.
Right.
You know? And there is sort of an obsession that we associate with L.A. with being healthy and being beautiful and all of that. Do you think that affects the relationship that Angelinos have with restaurants?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think that was a big part of the problem for a while. I think, but if you think about how many people live in Los Angeles, you know, even if 80% of them, which I don't think it's that high, are that type, there's still 20% or 25% who, you know, travel and are sophisticated and are into food and interested. So I think when we first, we opened Luke 10 years ago, and things were very different then. And it's funny because I remember when we first opened, I was terrified, and I sort of felt like, you know, I need to not, I mean, I cooked the food I wanted to cook, but I also felt like I had to be a little bit accommodating for, you know, the cliche typical Angelino diner. So, you know, when people would want a plate of steamed vegetables or whatever they would want, we would make it for them. Mm-hmm. Until we realized that, you know, there was one Saturday night, we'd been open like 3 months, and I remember it was I was picking up 10 veal chops, it was some big pickup. There were 10 veal chops, and one of them was the way that it was on the menu. And one was with mashed potatoes, and one was sliced with something, and one was with steamed carrots, and that's when I just sort of was like, okay, forget it. This is, like, I can't make the one guy's veal chop, the one guy who ordered it the right way, or my way, I can't make his veal chop right because I'm busy running around peeling carrots and, you know, mashing potatoes and doing all this other stuff for these other people. So that was when I kind of realized, you know what, there's enough people coming in here that I need to do this for the people who get it.
And that was basically a scene right out of L.A. Story, I guess.
Yeah.
Now,
and so that was at that moment I just started, you know, it was, you know, so we got very strict. There's no substitutions. You can't change things. You can't. And I think we scared off, you know, those people went back to the Ivy or wherever they were supposed to be, and which was fine because they were there because we were new and hot, and they weren't there for the food. They were there because it was the place to be because we had just opened.
And they were leaving anyway when the next place opened up.
Yeah, exactly. So well, it helped us to, that was how we sort of found our crowd, and I think over time I've been able to, you know, there were certain dishes that we, you know, I would put on the menu and think, like, no one's going to order rabbit. No one's going to order sweetbreads. No
well,
one's going to order.
Let's leave it there for just a moment. We have to take a quick break. We'll come back in a moment with Suzanne Goen from L.A., one of the best chefs out in L.A. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and stage left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The maragatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're speaking with Chef Suzanne Goen. She's owner of Luke and AOC Restaurant in Los Angeles. We're talking about Angelenos in general, and you were telling us before the break about how you had your epiphany where you finally, you know, we've all seen L.A. Story with, you know, how Angelenos want, you know, half decaf, half calf skim lattes with, you know, all the special sides. And you decided, you had an epiphany where you said, you know what, I just need to say no.
I can't do this.
I can't do this. Exactly. And then once I said that, it was sort of like the real people came out, you know, well, the people who got it and the people who... It's actually the same thing happened when we opened our second restaurant, AOC, which is a wine... I mean, it's a full restaurant, but sort of the heart and soul of a wine bar. So we have 50 wines by the glass. We have a huge selection of cheese and charcuterie. And I remember even potential investors saying, no one in L.A. is going to eat cheese. Are you guys crazy? What are you thinking? And we had so many people come to the door and say, oh, my God, I love cheese. Thank you guys for doing this. Why has no one done this before? Why is there... So I think as much as we are not serving, we're not serving everyone in Los Angeles, but there's a big enough crowd of, you know, I hate that term, but foodies,
mm-hmm.
that can sustain us.
I thought you were going to say fat, you know, people.
I wouldn't get that carried away.
Suzanne, our philosophy in our restaurant is I never want to say no, unless saying yes will negatively impact the other diners. And what it sounds like from you is that if you're making 10 veal chops 10 different ways, that is going to have a negative impact on the other diners. The problem isn't that I refuse to make your veal chop the way you want it.
It's that I can't do
it all.
The problem
is that I can't be everything to everybody or we'll sink the ship.
Right. And the nice thing now, 10 years later, is I can. When someone comes in and they want a steamed vegetable plate, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're very accommodating to vegetarians. We, you know, there's we can do it now. It was just like in that moment of like the first year and just the craziness was that we just couldn't do it. It was good because those were the first year people who were, they weren't coming back.
Right, exactly.
They were there because their friend, you know, it was in W or because their friends told them or whatever they were there for.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back more and speak with Suzanne Goen about Los Angeles and the restaurant scene out there. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Suzanne Goen is one of the top chefs in L.A., which makes her one of the top chefs in the country. Her restaurants are Luke and AOC. She's also co-owner of the Hungry Cat restaurants with her husband, Chef David Lentz. And she's also won a James Beard Award for her cookbook, Sunday Suppers at Luke.
Suzanne, you've worked at most of the great restaurant cities in the world, Paris, New York, Boston, San Francisco. What made you go back to L.A.? I know you had some roots there, but why did you decide to open your restaurants in L.A.?
Because I'm from here, and I had my family's here, and it was I think it was a perfect combination to get to go see other places for, basically I was away for 10 years, and to see other things, and then to come home. It was actually fun for a while there to be, I was always kind of like the restaurant orphan, you know, the people would invite me over for Thanksgiving and all that kind of stuff, and it was nice to come home and just be in your hometown and serve people who you know and be with my family, and it's just home to me.
You created a resume that is basically a resume of a celebrity chef. I mean, your resume, if you go down and look at what a celebrity chef should do to become
to
a celebrity
there.
Chef, it's basically you would look at your resume and say, okay, follow Suzanne.
You know, the one place I didn't work that was on your list, I didn't want to correct you, but I actually never worked in New York.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Sadly for me.
Okay. Well, you worked at basically some of the greatest restaurants in the world, and you followed that, what would be the resume of a celebrity chef. Was there anything purposeful about that, or is that just where the wind blew?
No, you know, I think my purpose was, when I, you know, started, there was Wolfgang Puck, but there wasn't really this whole celebrity chef, Food Network-y, all that kind of stuff wasn't really in existence. I mean, when I decided that I wanted to be a chef or work in restaurants, people were looking at me like I was crazy. Like, what are you talking about?
Right, it was Julia Child on Channel 13.
Yeah, it's like, what are you talking about? You're going to work in a restaurant. And so my goal, I sort of came at it from a food lover, an eater as well as a cook. And so I just wanted to work places where I love the food. I just wanted to, which is what it sounds so obvious, but it's whenever people come and ask for advice or career change people or whatever, it's like, that's like, don't think about where, you know, you think is the hot place or where you think is going to look good on your resume. Go where you, to learn to cook the food you want to eat. So that was sort of what kind of guided me. So I had, I didn't go to cooking school, but I had grown up cooking out of all of the Chez Panisse cookbooks, and I had, you know, heard of, you know, I very much knew about it. I had only eaten there once, but that was sort of, for me, like the ultimate place. And so I had heard these rumors that, you know, it was like a 10-year waiting list to work there and all this stuff. And so I actually, when I had been working in Providence after I graduated from college, and I worked at Al Forno, which that one I actually kind of stumbled into because I was in Providence, Rhode Island. I went to Brown. There's no other reason I would have been in Providence, Rhode Island. And
I just want to interject for a second, Suzanne. There is only a 9-year waiting list to wait to work in our restaurants. So
okay.
Just for
I know, me too. There's like a 9-minute waiting list.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I Al Forno I'd found. I mean, I had never heard of it. I was living in Providence, and I just, you know, Providence is a pretty small town, and I found Al Forno, and I don't know if you guys have been there. It's an amazing, amazing restaurant. Or wasn't it? I mean, it's still there, but it was when it was in the little place. It was really amazing, and I went to eat there a couple times, and I was blown away. And that was when I was like, well, I want to work here because I want to learn how to do what they do. And so I worked there actually the 3 years during college, and then when I graduated, the chef was leaving to open his own place. So I went and worked with him because I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I want to open my own place someday, so I should see what that's like. And then when I was ready to do something else,
So after you saw what that was like, you still did it?
I know. It takes a certain breed, right?
Yes, it does, unfortunately.
You can understand. And anyway, I wrote this letter to Alice Waters or to Chez Panisse, and more asking for advice, like, should I go to France? Should I move back to L.A.? What should I do? And they, you know, offered to, you know, well, when you're out here, why don't you, you know, come meet with us? And I went out there, and I actually ended up spending 3 days, you know, prepping, and I stayed at night and blah, 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 and I ended up getting a job there. And so that was, I mean, I went to go work there not because I thought it would look good on my resume, but because that was, to me, the ultimate place to work. That was what I wanted to learn.
Can you tell our listeners what it was like to work for Alice Waters?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, it was sort of like fantasy land. When you, working there, it was, I would get up, you know, in the morning, or I'd be there at work, and you'd have to go down these back stairs outside to go downstairs to the main kitchen. And I remember walking down those stairs and thinking to myself, like, I can't believe I get paid to be here. it was like a little junior chef in training fantasy land. I mean, Alice, of course, is amazing, but everyone who works there is, first of all, most of the people I worked with, and I worked there in 90 and 91, I would say 70% of people are still there, which is pretty insane. So just everybody I was working with was just a really great cook and really passionate about what they were doing. So I learned so much just from the person, and I was like the baby of the gang, you know, and it was, I learned so much from every person I stood next to and worked with, so... It was amazing. It was really amazing.
Well, so
very
now,
civilized.
Well, so now let's talk about how that's translated into your life. Now, in your restaurants, Luke and AOC, what sort of drives your choice of food or your cuisine? Or you know, did you make it specifically adjusted for Los Angeles? Or talk to us about how that's where your philosophy is now.
Well, I would say I don't make it specifically adjusted to Los Angeles, except for the produce. It is very... produce-driven and becoming more, I mean, that was the idea when we started, but now we've really, I mean, everything is local, everything's from the farmers, and so basically the way I decide what I'm going to cook is, you know, what are they growing right now, or what's coming up in the next few weeks, and then that's what I base the menu around. Now, that being said, it's not a vegetarian menu at all. I mean, we have sweetbreads and guinea hen and duck and veal cheeks and all kinds of things, but what guides me is what's going to come with it, you know, the vegetables and the herbs and all that kind of thing. And I feel like I sort of have this, it's my responsibility, or it's my side of the coin for getting to work with all this great produce, is it's my job to figure out how to use everything that they're growing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely like the guiding point. I mean, I think that in terms of influences, I think that's another reason it was good to work, you know, work different places and work for, you know, outside of my realm for 10 years, because I worked for Todd English, who has a very sort of, I think we both have a very kind of rustic thing, but he has a very different style than I do, and I learned a lot from that, and to work at Arpège in Paris and to work all these different places was, I think that's how you develop your own style, is by working with other people and picking up things along the way, and then as you develop, you come up with your own style and kind of what speaks to you, so...
Do you feel an additional responsibility to be socially responsible, having worked at Chez Panisse for Alice Waters?
Definitely. That's a part of it. And you know, I'm nowhere near doing what she does, but I'm trying, and we're pushing and trying to get there. It's hard. I mean, the balancing being a, I feel like being a business owner, I have responsibility to my investors. I have responsibility. Mm-hmm. My family, I have a responsibility for all the people who work for me, you know, and so it's tricky because there's times when you would like to pay people more, or you'd like to do different, you know, different things, and it just doesn't work into the equation, and that's hard, so but we're working on it.
I think sometimes people don't realize that they don't have to necessarily be Alice Waters to make a difference, to do things that do have an impact, and you know, we all can't be Alice Waters, okay?
Right.
She's doing something very, very special and has been for a really, really long time. But at the same time, we can make steps. We can do things. You know, we have solar panels on our roof. We try and source our bottled water locally. We do some things like that. And no, we can't do everything all the time because we are a business concern. But there are steps that every owner of every business and every restaurant can do.
And you're known for the steps that you take in your restaurant to be environmentally conscious and the like. Can you talk to us about some of the things you do besides just sourcing water?
We do composting. We compost everything. We work with one of our farmers who takes the compost, and you know, we brings us back that, you know, we sort of have, when he delivers produce, he'll take the compost with him. You know, we work with, you know, cleaning products and soaps and things that are more environmentally sensitive. You know, it's funny. We used to really work with, you know, to not recycling container, you know, using containers over and over again. But the health department sort of put a, you know, for a while we were really, you know, we weren't buying any plastics. We were using, you know, lids, so we didn't have to use plastic wrap and all this stuff. And then the old health department kind of.
So what kind of things would the health department object to that weren't really a problem, but they just didn't fit into their
model?
Well,
things like, I mean, your containers have to be NSF. Everything has to be NSF approved. Everything has to be, everything has to be, not made by a certain company, but made in a certain way. Everything has to be, if a container, if a lid has a little chip in it, you can't use it, like all
yes.
that kind of stuff.
Well,
so there's sort of a...
And so it also either has to be in the original packaging or in approved containers, and those
yeah.
approved containers don't always
yes.
and are frequently plastic.
Yes.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, Suzanne, and talk with you about your book, Sunday Suppers at Luke. That's a fascinating topic and a great book. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by-the-glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years' experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're speaking with Suzanne Goen, chef of Luke and AOC Restaurants in Los Angeles. Now, Suzanne, you have a book, Sunday Suppers at Luke. Mark, one of our restaurants is an Italian-American restaurant, and we always have Sunday dinner there.
Oh, great.
That, you know, starts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's based on sort of the traditional Italian Sunday dinner that Mark had at his grandma's house.
Only like 42 times a year.
Yeah.
That's so great.
Talk to us about Sunday Suppers at Luke.
Well, we do. Every Sunday we do a different menu. It's a 3-course prefixed with it's one appetizer, choice of 2 main course, and one dessert. And it's $40 a person. And, it changes every week. Basically, post the menu online on I try to do it by Wednesday nights. And we've done it since we first opened. And the idea was actually sort of a similar thing. When I was a kid, it was a very kind of untraditional thing, but my father was really into cooking, and we used to, you know, spend, it was actually Saturdays at our house, but my dad would spend all day cooking some crazy concoction. He was actually not Italian, but he was really into Italian food, but he was into this kind of old traditional recipes, so he would make these, like, pasta rusticas and, you know, with beans and cabbage and pasta and big bowls of, you know, steaming goodness with Parmesan and olive oil over the top.
It all sounds pretty good.
It was really good. It was fun. We would eat that year round. It didn't matter if it was like 90 degrees. We would sit outside and eat these like steaming bowls of, you know, Italian rusticity. But I just loved that. I just loved that idea of like being around a table and being with your family. I think it's probably partly from that, and also partly from just like the prefix menus in, you know, in small restaurants in France where you come in, it's written on the cutting board, you know, written on the
chalkboard.
Mm-hmm. On chalkboard, maybe on the cutting board too. You know, lamb and white beans or whatever it would be. So it's really fun for me. It's like a moment to, you know, as much as the menu is, you know, seasonal and driven by the ingredients, the menu has to be, you know, it's six appetizers and 9 main courses, and they have to all work together, and it has to be one sort of, you know, they have to all work in concert. Whereas this is, you know, when the first kumquats come out, or the first, you know, or when the farmers has a big brush on avocados or whatever it is, that's my moment to kind of, you know, play around with that specific ingredient. It's also great because, as you know, it's like it makes me once a week really like be creative.
You have to think. Introspect.
Yeah, you have to think. Whereas like it's easy to, if you don't have that, you can kind of, you know, let a couple of weeks go by without playing around with something because you're so busy doing whatever other things you're
right,
doing.
Right. Are there a lot of things to run running restaurants?
Oh, yeah.
Does that keep you busy at
every
all?
Once in a while.
Well, now, do you find that the customers that come in for this are the same customers, or that's it's a hugely popular thing? Or?
It's a hugely popular. It was popular before my book. Uh-huh. We used to do 150 people a night. Which it was kind of like our second biggest night after Saturday. And we have a ton of regulars. I mean, I would say it's 30%, 40% regulars, meaning like the same people every week.
That's wild.
And then after my book, now it's like 240 people.
That's great.
Yeah, well, it's great. It's funny. And in the beginning, you couldn't pay anybody to come. I mean, it was, it's not the regular menu. No, there's no choices. What do you mean? And now people get it. You know, it's like coming to somebody's house for dinner. You know, you don't know what you're going to get.
And so you don't offer the regular menu on Sundays?
No regular menu. Mm-mm.
That's wild. That's great.
It's the Sunday menu, yeah.
All right, well, we have a couple minutes left, and I want to touch on one thing. You were included in a book written by someone else, Melanie Dunay's book, The My Last Supper, 50
yeah.
Great Chefs and Their Final Meals, which is a book asking 50 great chefs about what they'd have for their final meal with photo portraits by this amazing photographer.
Yes, she is amazing.
And you, is it required that if you're a chef from L.A., you have to be photographed barefoot on the beach? Is that
probably.
That's a great photograph. That was a great honor to be in that book, and your photograph is beautiful. It's great.
Thank you. It was funny. When she first called me, I was like, is this a weird... I remember I asked Carol, my business partner, I was like, okay, so she wants to know what I would eat on for my last supper. Is that weird? Is that morbid?
Well, now the answer is...
At least I don't have... Do you see Anthony Bourdain's picture?
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So you knew he was going to be a little wacky, but, you know,
right.
You got Rick Bayless here.
For those of you who haven't seen the picture or heard the show that we did with Melissa, that Anthony Bourdain is basically naked holding a large cow femur in front of himself. So.
Yeah, and precariously placed. But, you know, you've got Elaine Ducasse, and you've got some of the best chefs in the world
here.
Yeah,
no, it's amazing. And she went with Danielle Boulou. They flew to Versailles to take his picture at Versailles.
It's a great picture.
She told me that she had to pick up his tuxedo and bring it from New York in order for him to be able to get it. Well, now
I didn't make her pick up my jeans.
Well, we only have a minute, but tell us about your last meal on Earth.
My last meal on Earth. Well, you know, it's funny that I think the book is sort of divided between people who go way over the top for their last meal and then people who go, you know, very kind of down home. And I was, of course, one of the down home types. I wanted. I think it's suckling pig and a big heirloom tomato salad and delicious cheeses and bread and Bandol Rosé and Langenried Cab Franc to drink.
Bandol Rosé and Langenried Cab Franc. You're a dork just like we are.
I am. I know.
Hey, listen.
It's funny, the Langenried, I was thinking, you know, she's like, do you don't want some big Burgundy or something? It's like, that's the wine that's what we had at our wedding. I mean, that wine, you know, I think, and that's the thing about food, that it's not just about, like the Grand Chateau or whatever. It's about what that food means to you.
And it's about time and place. And
exactly.
Food and wine has a time and a place, and you connect to that.
Hey, Suzanne, will you hang out with us over the break? Because I have one more question I want to ask you, and we'll do it on the other side of the commercial.
Sure.
Well, so stick with us, and you too can find out what that question is. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're speaking with Suzanne Goen, great American chef from Los Angeles. And we're talking about, Suzanne, before the break, that you were included in Melanie Dunay's book, My Last Supper, 50 Great Chefs and Their Final Meals. Amazing book. We talked about what your last meal would be. The same question was posed to 50 chefs, but there were some other questions about your last meal. One of the things that I found most striking about your answer that was different from most... one of the questions asked was, who would prepare your last meal? And your answer was, I would have someone extremely talented, but he or she would never be seen throughout the day. You're the only person that answered quite that way in this book of chefs. Why is that? I find that fascinating.
I guess you really don't like chefs, huh?
No, I do. A lot of my best friends are chefs. I think in that, if it was really, you know, it's so funny. When you start to think, like, okay, theoretically, Last Supper, and then you start to think, okay, what if that really was? You know, this is your last meal on Earth. And, like, I want to be with my husband and my family and now my kids. And, you know, I don't want to have to say, like, oh, everything was great. Thanks. You know, well, even if it was great, you know, I just sort of, I think I just wanted to be with my intimate.
You know, it's funny. I had a friend of ours who's a good friend, who's a restaurateur, who talked about coming to the restaurant. And he said he went to a restaurant and that a friend of his owns. And someone, he asked them the question and they said, you know, Would you tell me if things went wrong? And he said, oh, absolutely not. I'd say everything was great and it'd be fine. And I said, wait a second. Is everything great here? He's like, oh, yeah, everything's great. It's fine.
You'll never know.
I said, oh, but wait a second. He said, well, I'm here, aren't I?
You're not helping me.
Oh, yeah. Lord.
That's so funny.
Well, Suzanne, it was a ton of fun having you on the show. You're doing great work out there in Los Angeles, and we'll have to come see you when we get out on the West Coast next.
Please.
It was super.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Suzanne Goen and her restaurants are AOC and Luke in Los Angeles. Sunday Suppers at Luke is the book you can pick up. You can find more about this stuff on our website. I hope that you've enjoyed the hour with us at The Restaurant Guys half as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC, times 12 noon.